Hello and welcome to Launch. We're broadcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm Ron Reardon. My co-host is Bill McHenry. Bill, how are you today?
Fantastic, Ron. How are you?
Yeah, doing super. You know, Bill, on Launch, we focus on the launching of a business, you know, the planning that precedes that launch, the launch itself, the missteps and successes of the launch so that the entrepreneurs can successfully navigate their launch. This morning, we'll be featuring John Watkins of Barnes & Thornburg. But before we get started, Bill, could you thank today's sponsor?
Well, sure, Ron. Today, our sponsor is Patents & More. Patents & More, protecting your innovation and connecting you to the resources you need for success.
Super. Well, you know, John Watkins is a business litigation attorney, and he's practiced for over 25 years in Atlanta. He's been on the list of Georgia super lawyers for several years. He's actually written a book called An Insider's Guide on Hiring a Business Attorney and How to Make the Relationship Work. So, John, welcome to the studio.
Thanks a lot, Ron. It's great to be here.
Well, in addition to what I've just mentioned, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Well, I practiced in Atlanta for over 25 years. I started out in 1982 with the Hansel & Post firm, which was one of the biggest firms in Atlanta at the time. It became eventually the Atlanta office of Jones Day, an international firm. I had left before the merger occurred. Then I practiced for 20 years with Long Aldridge & Norman, which is now McKenna Long & Aldridge. And then in 2007, I went into the small law world, ended up practicing at Corey Taylor & File for 2.5 years, and have just joined the Atlanta office of Barnes & Thornburg, which is an Indianapolis-based firm with about 550 attorneys and a fairly new Atlanta office that is growing, and I'm excited about being a part of that.
Wow, John, that sounds really awesome. I'm really intrigued about your book, too, An Insider's Guide to Hiring a Business Attorney. Can you tell me what prompted you to write the book?
Well, Bill, I'm a litigator, at least primarily that's what I do, and I guess I deal with, as you might say, the sanitation service or train wreck side of the law. And so many times over the years, but particularly once I got into the small law field and started representing more small companies and medium-sized companies, I kept seeing time and time again situations where companies had gotten themselves into a lot of trouble that we were trying to clean up on the back end. And the common theme, there were all different kinds of problems, but the common theme that ran through each problem was that if the business had just had a good business attorney on the front end and had done the contract right or set up their business correctly, they could have avoided a lot of pain and expense on the back end. And what I found was that there wasn't a resource out there for helping folks, business folks, find, evaluate, work with an attorney. And so it seemed like there was a hole in the literature out there. So that's what prompted me to write the book.
Well, you know, at the beginning of most businesses, especially if it's a partnership, you know, everybody's happy and they love each other and they don't think about what would happen if one of them decides to go another direction or if they would have to dissolve the business or anything like that. Can you give some examples of legal troubles that happen if a business doesn't have a business attorney at the beginning?
Well, Ron, first of all, truer words were never spoken. When people are starting a business, they're happy, they're friends, they think it's going to go on forever. Let me give you an example that is true under Georgia law. It may not be true under the law of other states, but let's say that you're forming a new business and you're the money guy. You're providing the funds for the business, and you have a friend who is going to provide sweat equity, and your intention is to own 75% of the business and for them to own 25% of the business as a result of their expected contribution. Well, what you do is you pull a form off the internet, or you go to the Secretary of State's website and you form an LLC. You pay the fee, and you know you think you're in business. What could be simpler? Well, the thing a lot of businesses don't do is they don't do an operating agreement. And under Georgia law, if you don't do an operating agreement, a written operating agreement, the presumption is that you're equal partners. So 3 years later, let's say the business has been successful, you're making money, and all of a sudden you have a disagreement. And your partner, your supposedly minority partner, goes to see an attorney and finds out that, hey, they've got a pretty good argument that they own 50% of your business. 50-50 is a bad situation because then you're deadlocked and can't make any decisions, and the result may be litigation where a receiver decides what happens.
That's terrible.
It is terrible.
Jeez, oh,
it's very terrible. But it happens all the time.
You know, John, in this day and age of, you know, people can find, you mentioned finding forms on the internet and so on, and there's all these different legal document services and so on. What do you think of those places and the forms that are on those sites?
Well, I suppose I should preface this by saying I suppose in a way they're a competitor. So obviously take that fact into account in terms of what I'm about to say. But I'm not a fan of them. I don't understand how you can go to a website and answer some questions or just pull a form off the internet. And really, I think if you get a good result, it's more likely the result of good luck or serendipity than it is the fact that it's a good approach. I think, you know, lawyers do work with forms. There's no doubt about it. The difference is a lawyer has had the training and hopefully the experience to know what forms should be used. You know, for example, if you are entering into a relatively simple agreement, such as a non-disclosure agreement, the provisions that a lawyer will use if you're the party disclosing information may be somewhat different than the provisions a lawyer would use in writing that document if your client were to be receiving information. The interests are different in those circumstances. So it helps to know. It helps to have a lawyer who can guide you and take into account those interests. And I don't know how I'm a big fan of technology and software, but I don't know how software can do that.
You know, one of my favorite passages from a poem that I learned in high school says, "A little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not of the Pierian spring." And the internet can be dangerous in that someone thinks they've got all the information they need, but it's no substitute for however many years you got to go to law school plus, you know, the practical experience that an attorney has.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think that's true of any profession. We lawyers tend to be, as a group, know-it-alls. And one of the things that I constantly have to remind myself about and remind my colleagues about is that, you know, if you're doing PR or you're doing something that's not your field, perhaps you better let an expert guide you. And the same thing, you know, if you're not feeling well, you go to a doctor. You know, it's a little bit of common sense, but I think you're exactly right. The internet is such a great source of knowledge, and we have more knowledge and information at our fingertips, literally at our fingertips, than we've ever had. If you think back, you know, Ron, you and I are old enough to remember back to the 80s. We didn't have this kind of information available. If you wanted to research something, you'd go to a library and you'd get in the card catalog, or if you were a lawyer, you had a dedicated service such as Westlaw or Lexis available to you. But you know, now it's out there for everybody, and that's good, generally speaking. But you know, it's not only the knowledge that you need; it's the experience and the specific knowledge about how to apply it.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of times, you know, I'm a patent agent, and I only do patent law, and that's it. I don't do trademarks, licensing, anything like that. But, some, you know, clients will ask me about licensing. I said, well, here's a really good book on licensing. You know, I recommend that you read it, and then so you can be informed. But then go with a licensing professional if you want a licensing agreement done, you know.
Right.
Well, you know, your book recommends a very careful evaluation of attorneys' credentials. What do you have to say about credentials as a way of evaluating whether an attorney is going to be good?
Well, I think credentials are very important. And one thing we were talking about before we got on the air is the fact that, you know, generally speaking, it doesn't cost a lot more to hire a really well-credentialed attorney than an attorney that's not so well-credentialed. And a lot of people don't know this, but the book goes through. There are resources out there that allow you to find out about an attorney's credentials. And, for example, there's the Martindale Hubbell Law Directory, which is an old line, well-known law directory that lawyers use. We use it when we're hiring other attorneys. For example, if I have a client in Georgia who has a problem in Illinois, in a small town in Illinois, I can go to Martindale Hubbell and find out a great deal about attorneys in that town. And there are other resources available. But on your general question, I think credentials are very important. And I think if somebody did well in law school, that's a good thing. It's certainly not the be-all and end-all, and there are plenty of fine attorneys out there who didn't graduate at the top of their class. But if somebody did graduate at the top of their class, that's probably a good thing. If they have achieved some notoriety and accolades in the legal community, awards and so forth, if they've had experience in particular areas, all of that ought to be taken into account. And the book just gives you a step-by-step method of basically how to construct a spreadsheet to find an attorney and what you ought to be looking for.
How about that? Well, you know, a friend of mine was taking the Virginia bar several years ago, and she didn't pass the first time. And a lot of her colleagues, you know, who had passed the bar says, hey, don't worry, so-and-so on the Supreme Court didn't pass their patent, their state bar the first time, and they continued to have a very good, successful career and ended up on the Supreme Court. So, you know, just because, you know, how well they did in school or passing a particular bar is not, you know, the end-all, do-all, you know, of criteria.
I think that's right. And, you know, bar exams are tricky things. I remember I'd done pretty well in law school. I took the bar exam, and I felt like I'd been put through a ringer, and right. I was absolutely convinced I'd failed. Fortunately, I didn't. I'm not sure if I did very well on it, but I think that's correct. On the other hand, as I point out in the book, I think that if somebody, you know, did relatively well in their law school, if they were on the law review, if they were in the top 20% of their class, if they won some awards, it's probably to some degree a predictor of success. It's not. It's certainly not everything. And, you know, I wouldn't hire any lawyer just simply based on the fact they were a good law student. But it's something you need to throw into the mix. And, you know, if you look at the big law firms, the best law firms in the country, they all compete for talent and they all put a huge premium on academic credentials. And I think that says a lot. I mean, I think, you know, that's a criteria that the people who run the best firms in the country put a great deal of stock in, and I think people ought to look at it. But I think that there's experience and real-world abilities that go beyond that and need to be considered as well, and probably at the end of the day are even more important.
You know, John, one of the issues that always, I think, comes up with attorneys are the legal fees. Does your book provide any guidance on that issue?
There's a chapter on legal fees, and you know, Bill, that is always an issue, and there are lots of jokes we could tell about legal fees. But the fact is that lawyers are expensive. One of the jokes that is a headline for the chapter on fees is this guy was sitting in a bar having a beer, and he strikes up a conversation with this guy next to him who's a lawyer. And he finds out he's a lawyer, and he says, you know, I know a lot of people don't like lawyers, but I think you guys are all right. The only thing is you're so expensive. He says, tell me something. If I paid you $500, would you answer two questions? And the lawyer said, sure. What's your second question?
that's terrible.
But to get to the – it is a good joke. It's one of the best short lawyer jokes I know, you know. The subject of fees is always touchy, and the book does discuss fees and the range of hourly rates that you can expect in large cities. And also the book covers alternative fee arrangements, which has become a very hot topic in the law, things such as flat fees, reduced hourly rates with a success premium, contingent fees, many different ways that clients can work with lawyers. One of the things that is very true is that the recession we've been in the last 2 years has really prompted lawyers to get a little more creative and entrepreneurial about how they assess the fees rather than the hourly rate. Although I will say the hourly rate is a stubborn thing, and I think the vast majority of business work will continue to be done on an hourly rate basis.
Yeah, because I know I've seen billboards here in Atlanta that say, you know, uncontested divorce, $499, you know, which, you know, obviously is a flat fee rather than hourly fee. You think that flat fees are going to be, you know, continuing to grow, or were they, you think the balance between hourly and flat is going to stay the same?
I think, I definitely think flat fees are going to become more common. There are certain, from a lawyer's point of view, there are certain circumstances that tend to lend themselves to a flat fee. For example, if somebody wants a particular document prepared that's a very defined task, I want a non-disclosure agreement, here's what we're going to do. That type of situation lends itself very well to a flat fee. Litigation doesn't really lend itself very well to a flat fee. The reason is because the fee is going to be dictated, the amount of work is going to be dictated in large part by how the other side fights. You know, are they cooperative? Are they fighting on everything? And you can't control that. So I don't think you're going to find too many flat fees in litigation, but one thing in litigation that is a possibility is, for example, a reduced hourly rate with a partial contingency fee, which would be, you know, let's say the lawyer's rate is ordinarily $400 an hour. Maybe they would agree to do the work for $250 an hour for partners and $175 an hour for associates, the less experienced lawyers. And then if they're successful and they get a good recovery, they get 20% of the recovery as opposed to a standard contingency fee, which would be more like 33 to 40%. It's all negotiable. I mean, there are ways to do that. Now, of course, that only applies in the event you're the claimant. If you're defending, that type of arrangement doesn't work.
Okay. Well, you know, when you're looking to hire an attorney, there's sole practitioners, there's small law firms, there's large law firms. What does your book say about, you know, those different levels of organizations and as far as selecting somebody?
Well, I think there are a lot of factors that go into that. And, you know, my brother, Joe, who's a very good attorney, is a solo practitioner in Tucson. I worked for many years in the large law firm environment. The last 3 years I've worked primarily in the small law firm environment, and now I'm returning to the large firm environment. So I have a lot of experience with all those levels. The bottom line, Ron, is I think most clients hire lawyers. They don't hire law firms. And I think that is a good piece of general advice. However, as the book goes into, if a business is looking for a one-stop shop where they can expect generally good quality in multiple disciplines, probably a larger firm will provide that. On the other hand, if you have a specific issue, you may find the best attorney in town is a solo practitioner or is with a small firm. You just really have to evaluate each individual situation. I think, you know, generally speaking, you can expect lower fees in a small firm or for a solo lawyer. Although there are firms in town and in every town that are of any size that are considered boutiques where they're small, but they're highly specialized, highly credentialed, and they may charge as much or more as a big firm. So that all depends. You know, you're probably going to find, generally speaking, lower fees in a smaller firm, somewhat lower. You have to be, I think if you're going to a smaller firm, you have to do your due diligence maybe a little harder and check out the attorney's credentials a little bit better. There are many fantastic attorneys who work in small firms. There are many fantastic attorneys who work in big firms. One of the things that attracted me to a little pitch here for my new firm, the Barnes & Thornburg, is it's a big firm. It's headquartered in the Midwest. And we found that its rate structure was very compatible with our small firm in Atlanta's rate structure. And that was a big factor for those of us, the three guys who are joining that firm. that we didn't have to go over there and automatically tell our clients, hey, we're going to give you a huge rate increase here. And that was – so, you know, it just depends on the firm. And I have a chapter on the book, and I think at the end of the chapter I've kind of gone through the pros and cons of big and small and medium. And at the end of the day, it all comes back to what I said. Clients hire lawyers. They don't hire law firms. And but there are some general things. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, that's okay. Me too. Speaking of that, John, you know, thinking about working with an attorney, do you have any tips on that? I often think, you know, maybe if you were more organized when you go in to sit down with an attorney, where it would save time. You know, spending $250 to $500 an hour, it would be cheaper for me as a business owner to do a few things before I come in and sit down with you. What kind of tips could you give our listeners to prepare for their meeting with an attorney and maybe some cost savings and time savings?
Well, I think you really kind of hit the nail on the head. If you can come into a lawyer with – if you've got an issue, if you have all your documentation together, if you have it organized in a logical manner, which often is simply chronological, that tends to be how lawyers will end up putting it in order anyway. You know, because you kind of – it's like reading a story when you're reviewing the file. You start at the beginning and you work your way through. If all that's in a neat notebook or, you know, a neat series of files, it's a lot easier and quicker to get up to speed than it is if the client comes in, they don't have any documents with them. You then have to go through the process of pulling the information out of them. It's obviously going to be more expensive, especially, you know, you're probably going to be doing this on an hourly rate basis. More time equals more money. So that's a very good point. There's one caveat to that, though. I don't like my clients editing the material they give me. A lot of clients, and this is particularly true in litigation, a lot of clients will think they know what's relevant, and they'll think they'll say, "Well, you know, I don't want John spending time looking at all this stuff, so I'm just going to give him what I think's important." Well, that's a road to disaster.
Sure.
Especially in litigation, because you know you're going to have to consider in the discovery and disclosure process whether that material has to be produced. And the general rule is that full disclosure. So unless it's privileged or unless it's clearly not relevant. So you know, it's great to have a client that'll help you put stuff together that will be organized. That does save time and it does save money. But on the other hand, you don't want the client thinking they know, you know, what I call playing lawyer. That's just a version of playing lawyer when they edit the material or select the material they want you to look at.
Well, when you were in grade school, high school, college, when did you make the decision to become an attorney and to practice law? How did that come about?
I have no idea. I just my father was an academic. He ended up being a college president, and he had three sons. I'm the oldest one, and for some reason, I always knew I wanted to be a lawyer. And I don't know if it was Perry Mason or whatever, and that's such a false thing because law is not like Perry Mason ever. You know, my plan was always to go to law school, and I don't know, maybe the science and the dissections and blood and guts didn't appeal to me, so you know, it was I went to college and got a degree in political science and a double major. The other major was speech communications, and you do one of two things with that: you teach or you go to law school. So I went to law school.
That's fascinating because you know I took business law both in undergrad and when I got my MBA, and absolutely loved it both times. You know, it was just fascinating to me, just little nuances of, you know, a lumber company issuing their first check on chunks of wood and was it negotiable. I don't know if you had that same kind of thing in your courses, but I just love things like that. This is fascinating stuff.
It is. I will say this, if I had to do it over again, I would probably study either business or engineering as an undergraduate discipline, because I do a lot of technology related stuff for my clients, and you know, I picked it up, but it would be nice to have a little engineering background. I deal with a lot of engineers, and I picked up a lot about business, but I took some business courses, but you know, not a heavy dose of them. I didn't get a business degree.
Right. Well, this is really a cool book. You know, how can our listeners get a copy of it?
Well, it's pretty easy. The easiest way is to go on Amazon.com and just search in the search box for Insider's Guide on Hiring a Business Attorney. It'll pop right up. It's there. It's also available at BarnesandNoble.com and through a whole bunch of other online distributors.
Okay.
And I think if you go on Amazon, they actually provide links to other sellers. They have Amazon to me is a fascinating company. It's done some amazing things.
I agree with that. I've been following them since pretty much when they started. But it's been great having you in the studio today. How can our listeners get in touch with you?
Well, my email is john.watkins@btlaw.com. That would probably be the easiest way.
Okay.
And love to hear from everybody. And, you know, it's been great. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. It's been great having you here. I've learned quite a bit. Well, it's thanks for being on our show today, John. Our listeners have gotten some great nuggets and learnings that they can use in their launching journey, especially, you know, before they launch, contact an attorney, right? The right one.
Just one final thought. When people start a business, they seem to think an accountant, having an accountant is essential, and having a lawyer is a luxury. I would say this. Having an accountant is essential, but it's also a good idea to have a business lawyer, at least for a little consultation, to keep you out of that trap I mentioned earlier and some other traps, and could also help you with your taxes. And the final thing is you might want to have a good insurance broker.
That's true. That's true.
Well, in fact, John, I always said that when I started my businesses, it was a three-legged stool. You had to have a good legal counsel, a good CPA, and then a really good business advisor. And really start and think of building your business as a building, and you really need to have a real strong foundation, and those three things are your foundation.
I think that's true, and the ultimate goal of any lawyer is if you can become a trusted advisor for your clients, a real resource for them, know their business and know how they work and how to help them, that's the ultimate.
Okay. Well, thanks again. It's an insider's guide to hiring a business attorney and how to make the relationship work. Everybody should get a copy and commit it to memory. And our guest has been John Watkins. Another great show, Bill.
Gosh, John, or rather, Ron, just fantastic again today. Thanks again, John. I also want to give a special thanks today to our sponsor, Patents & More, your trusted guide through the innovation jungle.
And tune in each week at this same time to listen live or go to the blog at thelaunchhour.businessradiox.com to listen at your convenience. This is Ron Reardon, Bill McHenry, signing off another great session of The Launch Hour.